Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call. It's our One Planet series today. During Donald Trump's inaugural address, he claimed he would revoke the electric vehicle mandate. Now, there actually was no national mandate, but the message was clear, as it had been for years coming from Trump. Electric vehicles are a bad idea, and Trump was going to stop their spread. And yet he then entered the White House with Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla, one of the world's biggest electric vehicle companies. And in response to Tesla stock drops, Trump essentially offered a Tesla infomercial from outside the White House. And over the last several months, Musk's association with Trump have helped drag Tesla sales down. The company's first quarter profits were 40% lower than last year's. So how is the EV market doing? Are politics affecting the future of electric vehicles? We want to get beyond the hype and the headlines today. And to help us with that, we're very pleased to be joined by John Volker. He's been covering the electric vehicle industry for 15 years. He's currently a contributing editor at Car and Driver, Green Car Reports, Inside EVs, and other outlets. John, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you for having me.
And I have to just apologize to listeners in advance. I'm a little under the weather, so my voice is a bit scratchy. I appreciate everyone bearing with me today. So first of all, John, just want to clarify, Trump has promised to do a lot of things to roll back electric vehicles in this country. But what has he actually done here now that we're past his first 100 days?
It's a great question. We have heard a lot of things that he said he was going to do, but those of us who have lived in New York know that Mr. Trump says many things, some of which happen, some of which don't. In that respect, he's rather like Mr. Musk, the CEO of Tesla. So I should point out, perhaps most importantly for people who have been considering buying an electric vehicle, as of today, the financial incentive to buy a qualifying EV, which is up to $7,500 for a new one, and with some limitations up to $4,000 for a used one, remains in place. So to get rid of that completely, despite what Mr. Trump said, requires an act of Congress. It is possible that the administration will tinker around the edges of the rules to make it much harder for a vehicle to qualify. But as of today, that has not happened. He also said he was going to have all EV charging stations at federal buildings ripped out. I have not personally seen any evidence that that process has begun, despite sort of a letter to that effect. Although I'd love to know some if there were some, because that'll be a story. And there have been a number of other things. I think the biggest and most interesting challenge is going to be many of the electric vehicle provisions and sort of money to subsidize industrial development of a U.S.-based battery cell fabrication and pack production ecosystem. Because about two-thirds of that money, which amounts to hundreds of billions of dollars, if all the projects that are announced get put in the ground, about two-thirds of those funds are actually going to red states. And we are already seeing congressional representatives sort of waving their hands and saying, yes, we absolutely need to cut all of this, but not mine, not the one in my district. So how that plays out is going to be interesting. But as of now, there have been a lot of proclamations and relatively little action as of late April to date.
And John, following up on your comments about the $7,500 tax credit, as you mentioned, that's something that Congress would have to undo, although, as you acknowledge, the Trump administration could potentially narrow who qualifies. Now, that's all going to get wrapped up in these big budget negotiations. Do you have any word as to when those budget negotiations might happen, and how strong could Republican dissent from cutting those federal tax credits be? Because we did see a letter, I think it was about 22 Republicans in the House, saying they did not want some of these Inflation Reduction Act credits to be revoked. So do you think that might sway Congress and ultimately persuading them to keep those tax credits?
You know, I honestly can't speak to that. I have enormous respect for our reporter colleagues who cover DC at this moment in time. I will leave those prognostications to them. But obviously, there are very narrow majorities in the House. And I think it was always expected that there was going to be horse trading in order to keep favored programs just to maintain enough Republican votes to get anything at all through the House. What those particular provisions are, because there are so many different things that individual members may want preserved, I can't weigh in on, and I'm certainly not going to put odds on anything passing or not.
Well, it is the tea leaves that everyone's trying to read, certainly in this field. I also wanted to ask you about lower fuel economy standards. That's something that Trump in his first term tried to push through, because we have national fuel economy standards that were tied to greenhouse gas tailpipe emission standards, which were tied to California's unique zero emission vehicle program. What are you hearing about what Trump either has done or might do on our fuel economy standards?
The new head of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has vowed to roll back tailpipe emission standards. That has to go through a rulemaking process per EPA rules. It can't just be done unilaterally. During the last Trump administration, they went through that process. There was some horse trading along the way too. And you may recall that a group of four and then five car makers cut a separate deal with the California Air Resources Board, essentially to comply with the stricter California standards on a slightly longer timetable. One of the things I think that I'd love people to understand is that the auto industry sort of genetically resists all regulation of any aspect of its products, business practices, distribution, et cetera, et cetera. But that said, more than anything else, this is an industry that invests hundreds of millions of dollars on new vehicles, new powertrains, et cetera, on fairly long time horizons, 3 to 5 years, sometimes 7 years. And more than anything else, the auto industry wants regulatory certainty. Yes, they would like pretty much any rule that's been enacted to be lifted or frozen or sort of tweaked, fine. But more than that, what is hardest for them, and we see this with tariffs as well, is being yanked back and forth when they have to invest hundreds of millions or billions of dollars over timeframes that are longer than any given US presidential term. They really haven't had regulatory certainty on tailpipe emission standards, let alone certain safety aspects, since about the year 2000. And it's been extremely difficult for them to plan in a logical, rational way where to invest, what to invest in, what technologies to adopt, what things to take off the market when they keep getting yanked back and forth.
And we're speaking with John Volker about the state of the electric vehicle industry. He's a contributing editor at Car and Driver, Green Car Reports, Inside EVs, and other outlets. And you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind. We don't want to take your phone calls as well. We'd love to open the phone lines and get some listener comments or questions for John. If you are considering buying an electric vehicle or leasing an electric vehicle and are concerned about federal policies, how they might change, and have questions, if you have thoughts about Tesla, how that company is doing or how it may be doing going forward, we'd love to have you join the conversation. The number to call to join is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, John, you mentioned the T word, tariffs. Of course, this is a moving target. The numbers seem to shift day by day, if not hour to hour. What do you hear about how the tariffs might impact electric vehicles and electric vehicles compared to internal combustion engine vehicles?
I think the highest level is that tariffs will impact the entire auto industry. Depending on the company, they may have more or less of an impact on the EVs within that company's model range, but it will throw the whole auto industry into turmoil if, in fact, the full slate of tariffs that have been announced actually come into effect. Consumers will see much higher prices at the dealership. Used car prices will rise as well. And there are some interesting effects when you get a little more granular. There was an article this morning in one of the Detroit papers that noted that something like 85% of all the Buicks sold in North America come from either Mexico or South Korea, both of whom would get very large tariffs. That could kill the brand. And it is interesting that while Tesla is one of the most American-made auto brands on the market, it too will suffer because it does import components, it imports certain minerals, and so no automaker, even if you have clout in the White House at this moment, is unaffected. And those that are affected worse are going to have to raise their prices. I think the estimates have been between 14 and 35% on any given new vehicle in the showroom. It's a really ugly picture if this stuff all stays. Again, I'm not going to try to handicap it. Folks in my business kind of gave up predicting some of this stuff.
Yeah, you have to give up because no, I don't think anyone knows. It seems like even Trump himself really doesn't know either, given how much policy is changing. And thinking about a trade war, you know, if China were to withhold exporting of rare earth minerals, for example, it is definitely a tough time for the entire auto industry, if not just for electric vehicles. So I think your point is well taken on that front. But as we're talking about the globe and global trade, how much of U.S. policy at this point really even matters considering the global picture for EVs? Can you talk about what's happening around the world? It seems like there's been tremendous progress, particularly in China, on EVs.
Absolutely. In 2014, China issued a plan called Made in China 2025. Not much noticed at the time outside the sort of Chinese business community, that essentially said, we're tired of being the factory for the world. We've gotten there. Sorry, I too am a little scratchy. And so it is time for China to become the dominant force globally in advanced technologies, from solar panels to battery cells to AI to self-driving vehicles, a whole slate of them. And the Chinese government has thrown hundreds of billions of dollars at doing that. And they invited Tesla in, and for the first time in 2019, gave Tesla 100% ownership of its factory. That made electric vehicles fashionable, trendy, and exciting in China. But finally, during COVID, their domestic industry caught up, and now Chinese-made vehicles are equal to pretty much anything in the world, and Chinese consumers are turning away from Western brands and buying their own, to the point where more than half the new vehicles sold in China any month this year are electric. They are way far ahead of the world. They have the lowest battery production costs. Obviously, they've spent 10 years locking up mineral resources. So the auto industry knows the entire world is going to move to electric transport. China wants to dominate that process, and it has spent 10 years putting itself in a position to do so. Europe is next. Europe has, I can't remember if the number is 18 or 20%. Fact check me on that one. I should have looked it up. But about 1 in 5 new vehicles sold in Europe is electric last year or this year. The U.S. is behind 10%, roughly. I do want to make the point that in the U.S., You may have seen headlines using words like plummeting for EV sales. That's simply not the case. EV sales last quarter were as high as they've ever been. They're just not at European or Chinese rates. There's obviously a great deal of incentive in the uncertainty in the market. And most importantly, when Tesla catches a cold, the entire EV sales industry in the US gets pneumonia, to mangle a metaphor, because Tesla has been an outsized portion of EV sales for the last 10 years. That's switching quickly because now there are viable Tesla alternatives for multiple brands, North American brands, Korean brands, even to some extent the Japanese brands. And those people who don't want to buy a Tesla because it's the only competent EV entry, which it was for a long time, now have viable alternatives. The sales of those alternatives are rising fast, even as Tesla has plateaued and is starting to decline. Mm-hmm. But Tesla's problems are beyond Musk's political activities. Musk has made a number of decisions at that company dating back to about 2019. His next new product, the Cybertruck, has been a sales catastrophe. I mean, they've sold maybe 50,000 in more than a year on the market when projections were for 10 to 20 times that number. It has become it's possibly the most polarizing vehicle on the road since the original Hummer. He hasn't invested in the $25,000 EV. And if any company in North America could have sold a bucket ton of cheaper, smaller EVs, it would have been Tesla. Instead, he's all in on self-driving, which most of the smart experts I know are highly skeptical about under his particular way of approaching the problem. And his high volume vehicles, the Model 3 and Model Y, are essentially old and stale now. They've been slightly updated. They're nicer inside and mildly restyled. The Model 3 is coming up on 10 years old. Model Y is 5 years old. In auto time, that's when you redo it and do a new car. So Tesla has multiple problems compounding each other, with Mr. Musk's political activities on top, probably being the ones that get the most press.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with John Volker, who's covering the electric vehicle industry. He's been doing so for 15 years, currently a contributing editor at Car and Driver, Green Car Reports, Inside EVs, and other outlets. And we have the phone lines open. If you're a Tesla Cybertruck driver and want to defend your purchase, or if you loathe the Cybertruck or would never buy a Tesla, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at yourcall@kalw.org. John, you talked about some of the decisions that Musk has made that have hurt the company. As you mentioned, the Cybertruck not selling very well and outdated Model 3 and Model Y models. But of course, he has also become now this outspoken firebrand for conservative causes. And some analysts have talked about how that has essentially permanently stained the Tesla brand among liberal, more affluent buyers by at least 10 to 15% sales in Germany after his Sieg Heil at the inaugural plummeted. And do you think that this is going to be a permanent problem for Tesla now going forward? Or is there any chance that he's made up for some of the lost sales among more liberal buyers, perhaps by MAGA buyers who might admire his joining at the hip with Trump?
That was one of the great open questions at the very beginning. Would, in fact, the losses among more progressive buyers be made up by increased sales among more conservative buyers? The problem is that that hasn't happened. Musk is viewed much more favorably by those on the conservative side of the voter spectrum, but by and large, that group is far, far less likely ever to buy an EV. There's a fair amount of active EV hatred out there. They admire Musk as a person for what they think he has done, but they're still not going to buy a damn EV. So, in fact, he has pretty much shot himself in the foot with the audience that is far more likely to have bought his cars or be in the market to do so. There has been no massive MAGA uptake of electric vehicles, whether Tesla's or anyone else's, that anyone can ascertain out of the data.
We have a question in John in San Francisco emails in to write, what should Tesla do now to pull out of its nosedive? So other John here, do you have any thoughts about what, if you were in charge of Tesla now, what do you think should be done to try to resuscitate the company?
How much time do we have? Number one, I think a case can be made that the board is not doing its job. The CEO of the company is about a 1/5 time CEO. He also runs four or five other companies, if you remember. And his political activities have been, I think the kindest way to put it, a distraction or not a positive for the brand. Whether the board would ever fire Mr. Musk, the consensus among the people I know seems to be not a chance. But in the end, it comes down to the board, who has a fiduciary duty to do whatever is best for Tesla's future success. Beyond that, presuming Mr. Musk stays, I think the idea of an inexpensive EV is the next big frontier. I'm thinking about this because I have an article for Wired coming up on this at some point in the future. But honestly, I think a $25,000 to $35,000 EV that's compelling, if not all the bells and whistles, could change the EV perspective in America substantially as cars continue to get more expensive. The average new car in America is now $48,000, sales weighted average. So Musk deliberately said, we are not going to do a $25,000 car unless it can be a robo-taxi. Well, most Americans do not buy robo-taxis. They buy individually owned cars for the use of themselves and their families. So I think Tesla could still do that. Whether it will is a different question. We've heard so far only that they're going to have a stripped down version of the Model Y. That's probably not enough.
Yeah. Well, and Waymo has really taken off in terms of its market share and pioneering these autonomous, essentially taxi cab rides in cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Phoenix. Has Tesla missed the boat? What's the technology difference here that might explain why Waymo seems to be so much farther ahead of Tesla on this idea of self-driving cyber cabs?
Great question. The technology difference basically is that Waymo uses what we call sensor fusion. They take data from a whole variety of different sensors, not only their camera vision, but also radar and something called LiDAR, which is kind of a rotating radar, if you like. Tesla has decided, or Mr. Musk has deemed, that it can be done with vision only. Immense amounts of processing, gathering data from every Tesla on the road to understand what the actual real world is, accumulating all of that data, and then using algorithms derived from that alone, vision data alone, to drive the car itself. I think it's indicative that General Motors, Ford, Mercedes, Benz, and I think one or two others now have officially approved hands-off adaptive cruise control. I drove one of them this morning, quite frankly, where it's like adaptive cruise control, but you can take your hands off the wheel as long as you watch the road, and the car will notice through eyeball cameras when you're not watching. Tesla does not have that approval. Tesla drivers must, at least in theory, keep their hands on the wheel. And there are various defeat mechanisms that many of them use, but Tesla's so-called full self-driving is not anywhere near what the name would suggest. And in fact, regulatorily, it is not as good as systems from other makers now.
If you're just joining us, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. We're talking about the future and current state of the electric vehicle market. We're joined by John Volker, contributing editor at Car and Driver, Green Car Reports, Inside EVs, and other outlets. The phone lines are open if you're an EV driver or if you are interested in getting an EV but concerned about the future of the market. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email questions to yourcall@kalw.org. And John, I wanted to ask you about Chinese electric vehicles. We've been talking about the U.S. market and Tesla, and I've heard Elon Musk, the CEO of Ford, express a lot of alarm about just how sophisticated, how inexpensive, how practical and well-designed and well-manufactured some of these newer Chinese electric vehicles are. Have you been able to see one of these new Chinese EVs up close? What have you been hearing about how far ahead China may be and what that might mean for U.S. EV manufacturers?
I think it's safe now to say that the best of Chinese EVs are the equivalent of the best of anyone else's EVs. They are largely tuned for their domestic market, which is to say they may need some adjustments to things like handling and ride quality when they get to other markets. But that's a fixable problem, presuming the Chinese do the same thing that the Japanese and the Koreans did and listen to the audience and listen to their distributors. But a lot of it has to do, a lot of the costs you see reflect an absolutely brutal price war amongst EV makers in China. It's going to be a kind of a fight to the death battle because China at this moment has several dozen EV car makers, which is way too many even for a market that size. They need maybe five. And so the strongest ones are trying to put the weakest ones out of business. Whether or not the rest of the world can create compelling products that differentiate themselves from whatever the Chinese bring, and they will come sooner or later, remains to be seen. But certainly there is a sense of renewed urgency to outright fear amongst the rest of the world's automakers at how good the Chinese have gotten, how quickly.
And I haven't asked you yet about California's policies. California has been, no pun intended, but a major driver of zero emission vehicles and electric vehicles specifically. And I talked in the opening about how Trump was singling out a national mandate for EVs, which doesn't exist, that he wanted to overturn. And so the question is, what are they doing on California's policies? Because California does indeed have a mandate that by 2035, automakers won't be able to sell new internal combustion engine vehicles on the road. So it doesn't mean internal combustion engine vehicles are banned, but there won't be any sales of new vehicles, at least within California's borders. What have you been hearing about what Trump is trying to do to California's policies and the other states that follow California's policies?
It is pretty clear that they are going to revoke California's waiver, which is the official term for permission given by the EPA to California to have stricter standards than the national emission standards, and to other states to pick one of two. They can either pick the national standards, or I think it's 14 states representing something like 40 or 45% of the new car market in the US have opted to follow California's stricter standards. So as it did in the last term, the Trump administration will again try to revoke California's waiver and make California subject only to national rules. And I believe the new head of the EPA, former Congressman Lee Zeldin, has already said that is going to happen. Again, the EPA has to go through a rulemaking process, show what has changed from the last time it granted the waiver. So they can't do it unilaterally, despite what I rather suspect is deep desire on the part of the administration just to get rid of it by the stroke of a pen. And so if the waiver is revoked, California will then sue and so forth. So I think the process of the administration trying to deprive California of its current status will take most of the current term if last term, and the last effort to do that is any kind of indication.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information on our website at kalw.org. You can also listen to past shows to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But we were going to take the second half of the show to talk about cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, but we are going to punt that topic for a different day and keep our current guest with us for a bit longer. There's a lot more to talk about on electric vehicles, and we have on the line, continuing on with us, John Volker, who's been covering the electric vehicle industry for 15 years and currently a contributing editor at Car and Driver, Green Car Reports, Inside EVs, and other outlets. And the phone lines are open for you, our listeners. The number to call to join the conversation, if you have been considering purchasing an electric car and maybe the events the last few months have changed your thinking, or if you have thoughts about people who buy Teslas, if you have criticisms of those decisions or thoughts about the company and its role in politics, you can join the conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at yourcall@kalw.org. We were just speaking with John about the California waiver. And the question is, as this rolls out and we see litigation over any attempts to roll back California's agenda, and we see the global market here taking hold, how much of this even matters at this point? Is there unstoppable momentum towards electric vehicles? And is this just a matter of how quickly we get there that the Trump administration might try to throw up these roadblocks?
I think the auto industry at this point globally has accepted that, yes, we will electrify transport over the next few decades. We have over 1 billion vehicles on the planet, so it will be well past the end of my lifetime before 90-odd percent of them are electrically powered. These are slow transitions. The metaphor I use is the arrival of catalytic converters. They came into the U.S. in 1975. It wasn't until the earlier mid-2000s before they were standard fitting for all combustion engines on pretty much any vehicle built globally. And that's just one component as opposed to a complete new powertrain. So it's going to take a while. It's being pushed by China. The interesting thing is in India now, there is starting to be significant take up of electric vehicles, although the majority of them at this point have two wheels, not four. But people understand in many different markets, in many different cultures, different countries, at different economic levels, that there are a lot of advantages to electric transport. For one, you can often plug in overnight when the grids are least stressed. Not that people particularly care about stress on the grid, but the utilities do. Number two, you generally have a full tank, if you will, or full range every time you plug in overnight. And number three, it turns out, and this is something that the auto industry hadn't really thought about, that there are a lot of people out there who feel insecure or vulnerable going to gas stations, and they really love the idea of never having to go to a gas station again. So when you add that with a quieter, smoother ride, great acceleration off the line, because everybody loves winning stoplight Grand Prix. I don't believe it when people say they don't. There are a lot of advantages to electric cars. It's just a big, big shift. And in North America, we are a much more dispersed country. We drive longer distances than in Europe or China. We tow things, although we don't tow as much as we say we do. And so we have larger, longer range, and more luxurious vehicles. EVs at this moment, given the state of battery development, are great up to about mid-sized SUVs. They're not particularly good replacements at this moment for towing 14,000-pound trailers. But you know what? That's fine. Let's get the low-hanging fruit first, which is a car used to commute in, used to take your kids to school, do mall runs. The current, say, 250 miles of range covers that just fine. But one of the hurdles, and we've seen two automakers try to overcome this. One of the hurdles is that people don't inherently think about plugging in at home. It's just, you don't have a gas pump in your garage, right? So the idea that you bring your car home and plug it in isn't a natural behavior until you sort of say, think of it as your cell phone, but on wheels, because you plug in your cell phone every night, right? Once people do that, and it sort of gets ingrained for a couple of weeks, you see among EV owners a lot of, I'm never going back. This is great. And part of the problem is that there's been a lot of confusion, disinformation, just general sort of not understanding, including, I would add, among auto salespeople who need to know this stuff but frequently don't, about what it takes to install a charging station for an EV in your garage. It's not going to dim your neighborhood grid. It doesn't cost $15,000. I spent a lot of my time busting myths about EVs, as you can imagine. But Ford has a program called the Ford Power Promise. And I mention a specific maker only because I was impressed. This is an innovative program where every Ford EV you buy, they've got three of them right now. One of them's an electric van. You get a free home charging station and free standard installation, which is to say they won't cover running more power from the curb to your house if you have a house built in 1900. But for most homes these days, at least a majority, they will cover the standard installation of putting in a new circuit, a new breaker in your box, wiring it up to a charging station. That gets a lot of people over the hump of, gee, I'd like to buy an EV, but oh, this charging station stuff, that just sounds difficult and complex and expensive and confusing, and eh, maybe next time. Mm-hmm. And with that, they have actually seen EV sales go up. So there are a lot of new facets around buying and using an EV that car makers never had to think about before, but they realize they now have to. And they're starting to do some interesting programs to get people over the rough spots.
Yeah, new business model, new way that consumers are interacting with their vehicles. I want to go to the phone lines. We have Andy from Redwood City dialing in. Andy, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Elkind. Good morning, and good morning, Mr. Volkler, the guest.
Hey there.
Good morning.
I heard a report, I think it was on CBS News, about Tesla getting a special waiver from the Federal Department of Transportation as far as its driverless cars using as taxi service type applications, not having to report their accidents, having some kind of waiver. Do you know anything about that, Mr. Volker? Any color you could put on that, please?
I do. One of the difficulties for those companies that want to roll out driverless vehicles in various testing circumstances, robo-taxis, et cetera, has been that there are fairly restrictive rules on both what the vehicles must have. At this current moment in time, a driverless car must have a steering wheel and brakes that a human can operate, even if there's never going to be a human. But also, NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, requires all crashes and other incidents to be reported. Under the new administration, the reporting requirements have been slackened, and the specifics are that it used to be if any driverless vehicle had a crash that involved a tow truck, it had to be reported. They have somewhat lessened that rule to say if the vehicle has a crash that does not cause an injury, a death, or a police report, then in fact, they do not have to report it. And the practical use case of that is a self-driving car brushes a bollard or something like that. That said, it applies only to those makers who have what we call level two systems. Those are the hands-on systems I described earlier in the program, not the level three systems where you can have hands-off operation. So the fact that it only applies to this one specific level of self-driving vehicles means that it benefits numerically Tesla most of all. Does that help?
Yeah, thanks a lot for the clarification.
Great.
Pedestrians, I think, are going to have to watch out on some of the roads where those are being tested.
I think that's a great point. Yeah,
certainly any pedestrian who gets hit and injured by a self-driving car, that one must be reported. But it does certainly reduce the burden, apparently most of all, for Tesla among all the makers testing various levels of autonomy.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to thank Andy for that question. I have an email from Angel in Oakland who writes, Trump says he's an ally of the UAW, United Auto Workers Union. What's the UAW's current stance on EVs? John, any thoughts about where the UAW is on this?
I can't speak to the UAW specifically, but auto unions, both in the U.S. and Germany, worry, and their worries are somewhat justified because the estimate is that in series production at the same levels as conventional cars, an EV takes somewhere between 15 and 30% fewer worker hours to assemble simply because it has so many fewer components. Battery cell manufacturing is largely automated. So is, to a greater or lesser extent, battery pack assembly, and you don't have the literally thousands of parts that go into a modern internal combustion engine. So electric cars have fewer parts that need to be touched by a human during the assembly process. Arguably, that means fewer worker hours and hence fewer worker jobs. So there is concern in the unions in general about the impact of EVs, but I can't speak to the UAW specifically.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. And thank you, Angel, for the question. John, I know we'll only have you for just another minute or two here before you have to go. So I wanted to ask, what are you looking for now? What are some of the big upcoming events that you think could determine EV policy in the United States? What other stories do you have in the hopper that we can look forward to from you?
Well, I mentioned the one coming in Wired several weeks from now on low-cost EVs. I do regular reviews of EVs for a variety of outlets. And luckily, if you know how to spell my name, I'm very Googleable. But I think really what I'll be watching for the balance of the year are the overall percentage of EVs in the new car market. Does the percentage stay the same? Does it rise? Does it fall? And the balance between Tesla, which seems to be on something of a downslope, versus the other makers. Hyundai, Kia, and GM right now, and Ford, are all competing for the number two slot behind Tesla in terms of number of EVs sold. Thus far, they're not within an order of magnitude. Well, they're within an order of magnitude, but they're not close to Tesla's numbers. If by December, those numbers have gotten much closer, what it means is that people are quite happily buying EVs from established auto brands they know and trust. Then there are also the startups, Rivian and Lucid being the other two that are worth covering, both of which are going to introduce newer, lower cost, higher volume vehicles as well. So there are a lot of new vehicles coming out. I will be curious to see what the balance is between Tesla and the rest of that pool.
Well, John, I know you have to leave, but I just want to thank you for coming on Your Calls One Planet series and talking to us about electric vehicles and spending much longer than you originally signed up to spend with us. That's John Volker, who's been covering the EV industry for 15 years, contributing editor at Car and Driver, Green Car Reports, Inside EVs, and other outlets. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a delight to talk. So yeah.
Absolutely. We'll have to have you back on to continue this conversation. Well, we've got a few minutes left here on Your Calls at One Planet series. We were going to cover cutbacks to the National Oceanic Atmospheric administration, but we're going to punt that conversation. So we've got some time here to take some additional listener calls on electric vehicles. We have just a few minutes left. And I know we have a caller in, David from Berkeley, dialing in. David, I'd love to hear your thoughts about electric vehicles. So you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. We rushed in and bought Chevrolet Bolt, knowing that these the compensation taxes were going to disappear this year. So we bought it last year. We went in, and I have rudimentary basics ideas of electrical issues, but I didn't realize how much more efficient it is to use a level two charging and what it would cost. The electrician was, his labor was less than the materials to put in the 220 volt level two. And I just thought I'd put that out there. And also dispensing the myths about short range. 250 miles on a battery charge for the Chevy Bolt seemed to be fine with me. And I think I kind of know the automotive market. I've been in it for a while. It's a fickle market. They just jump to the next whizzing Star Wars type of machine. And people, I think, are looking forward to a smaller car. Apparently, Toyota's going to come out with that, finally, an EV 100% in a year or year and a half that might meet that. The Chevy Bolt, for instance, only about 14 foot long. And everything else is just a bolt on wheels. Or mm-hmm. the next, look what I spent or overspent on a vehicle that's just too large for city roads and parking. So
yeah,
things I think will change.
That's great. Well, David, I really appreciate you dialing in and talking about your experience with a Chevy Bolt and installing the level two charger in your, presumably in your garage. And I think that's useful for listeners to hear, especially those who might be on the fence about an electric vehicle. Just a couple minutes left. If anyone else has thoughts about electric vehicles and wants to join the conversation here, it's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And I'll just note David's comment about electrician working on the installation of his level two charger. A couple things I would add as someone who has studied electric vehicles and also has purchased and leased them myself. First of all, many electricians will tell people that you might need a panel upgrade to put in a level two charger. And I just want to let listeners know that there are a couple workarounds for that. First of all, you don't necessarily have to have the 220 volt charger for your electric vehicle. A regular wall outlet for many people, it actually would be sufficient. And overnight, you can get about 50 or 60 miles of range just plugging into a regular wall outlet. And so a level two may not be necessary for everybody, although it is a nice convenience and more efficient, as David mentioned. And then I'll just also add that there are ways to balance the capacity on your panel. There are devices called smart switches. And in fact, this is useful if you go to all electric appliances in your building as well. If you're switching off natural gas to heat pumps, oftentimes existing panels, even if they only have 125 amps, which is relatively small, they can be reconfigured with a switch device. So you can put two appliances on the same circuit, and then the switch will simply toggle them back and forth. As an example, our heat pump at my house will toggle off when I'm using our electric induction range cooktop. And then that's only using the cooktop for maybe 30 or 40 seconds. And then the heat pump will turn back on. And that has saved us thousands of dollars and a long time waiting to upgrade our panel. So I just want to let listeners know about that. I also want to let listeners know, if you're living in San Francisco, last week, a couple new curbside chargers debuted as a pilot program near DuBose Park from the company It's Electric, that started in Brooklyn, but is basically going to building owners with extra capacity who have curbside access and saying, look, if you want to make some money off your electric, extra electric capacity, we'll put in a charger, a curbside charger on the sidewalk in front of your building and split some of the revenue with you. And this is enabling some curbside charging in San Francisco for those who live in an apartment, don't have a place to park and want to be able to charge on the street. We also have a caller here. Deborah is dialing in. So we have a few minutes left. Deborah, I want to give you some chance to talk about electric vehicles. Go ahead.
Great. Good morning. I have had a Chevy Bolt and been driving it for 5 years, and I've had no problems, and I have not listened or, let's see, followed up on any of their postcards to me about how I should bring my Bolt in to have a new battery put in it. And I have not listened to, I guess I should put it that way, I have not listened to them tell me, oh, don't park your car in the garage. Because the battery will explode and your house will go down with it. I mean, there's all sorts of scary things that they've been saying to us. And this is the Chevy folks.
Yeah. No, Deborah,
so
I think
I can tell you.
Yeah, please continue. But we risk out of, okay, got to cut that off. I'm sorry, Deborah, because we're out of time, but a lot of misinformation about electric vehicles. More we'll have to cover on future shows, but that's our show today. To listen to past shows, sign up for our podcast, visit the website kalw.org. Andrew Steltzer helped to produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to those listeners who called in. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's your call.